From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk about film music with one of the most highly regarded living film composers. Elmer Bernstein wrote the scores for about 200 films, including The Man with the Golden Arm, The Magnificent Seven, The Ten Commandments, and the new films, The Grifters and The Field. Also today, Nick Park tells us about animating this year's Oscar-winning film, Creature Comforts. Artist Faith Ringgold answers the question, who's afraid of Aunt Jemima? And film critic Stephen Schiff offers a parent's guide to the Ninja Turtles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Kurdish opposition forces based in London claim that rebel forces have recaptured the key northern oil city of Kirkuk in a seesaw battle with loyalist troops, but government forces still claim to control the city. The BBC's Gerald Butt reports on the continued fighting.
A spokesman in Damascus for the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan said the army was using tanks and heavy artillery and both helicopter gunships and jet aircraft in attacks on rebel positions in some parts of Kirkuk and in towns all around. There's been no confirmation of the claim, the second in as many days, that fixed-wing aircraft are being used in violation of Baghdad's ceasefire agreement with the coalition allies. The Kurds have also again accused the army of using napalm and phosphorus around Kirkuk. A BBC correspondent in the town of Dahuk, north of Mosul, near the Turkish border, said many thousands of people, large numbers of women and children among them, were fleeing into the mountains to the east, fearing an attack on the town.
Gerald Butt, reporting for the BBC. Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin lost a bid today to create a popularly elected executive-style presidency for the republic. That item was taken off the agenda at the Congress of People's Deputies under pressure from communist hardliners. The hardliners are seeking to remove Yeltsin and may try to introduce a vote of no confidence in his government tomorrow. Yeltsin's popularity with the people was bolstered yesterday when tens of thousands of people demonstrated in his support in Moscow, despite a Soviet ban on the gathering. King Hussein of Jordan said today that eventually there will have to be an international conference to ensure a lasting peace in the Middle East. He made this comment following talks with French President Mitterrand in Paris. King Hussein said their discussions were the most frank and constructive to date. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The king said UN Security Council guarantees would be needed at some point, but he suggested the conference would not be appropriate yet. He said now is the time for diplomacy on the part of the five permanent members of the Security Council and other willing parties. This is his first trip outside the Middle East since the Gulf War ended, and it's part of a drive to end Jordan's isolation. The king said there was now a window of opportunity for peace, human dignity, and popular participation in the region. He said there were two main issues to be solved, the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Palestinian problem. He said the Palestinians should participate in an effective and committed way, according to their own choice. He said there had been far too many peace plans, and that now was the time for innovative thinking. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Carey in Paris.
A U.S. military spokesman in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, said today that three Marines are in good condition after having been wounded by an Arab gunman in a drive-by shooting. The spokesman said the Marines were fired upon as they rode in a U.S. military vehicle. This is NPR. The U.S. Navy has ordered courts-martial for two sailors who were charged with trying to lead a mutiny on a carrier in the Persian Gulf. The two men were said to be following Saddam Hussein's call for a worldwide holy war against the United States. Navy officials declined to say whether or not the two men were Muslims. The men were identified as 22-year-old airman apprentice Abdul Shahid of St. George, South Carolina, and 21-year-old James Moss of Columbus, Ohio. The two allegedly urged fellow sailors to sabotage the aircraft launching system aboard the carrier USS Ranger and to kidnap the captain. Rival South African political leaders Nelson Mandela and Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi plan to hold urgent talks tomorrow to try to stem the violence between their supporters. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Since Mandela's release from jail 13 months ago, Mandela and Buthelezi have met once on January the 29th this year. They pledged to work for peace and political tolerance between their two organizations, but hundreds of lives have been lost since then. Tomorrow's meeting will take place in the port city of Durban. It came about because violence between the two groups is escalating, topping 100 in one township in 3 weeks. There were two more killings sometime last night in Alexandra Township near Johannesburg, and 5 people have been found shot dead since yesterday in Ndeleni in Natal province. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hills accused China today of unfair trade practices and widespread pirating of American books, films, and tapes. The charges came in Hills' annual report on trade barriers around the world. The report came as China posted a $10 billion trade surplus with the U.S. for 1990. That was up from just over $4 billion the year before. Joshua Bolton, the trade representative's special counsel, said that China is on a priority watch list along with Brazil and India. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may sound improbable that the composer who wrote the big biblical music for the epic The Ten Commandments also wrote the sneaky, stylish music for the current crime film The Grifters. But my guest Elmer Bernstein did both. It shows his range and his longevity in the business. He's written about 200 other film scores. His music for the 1955 film, The Man with the Golden Arm, was one of the first jazz scores and paved the way for the many that followed. He also wrote music for Some Came Running, Walk on the Wild Side, To Kill a Mockingbird, and The Magnificent Seven, as well as the current film, The Field. Let's listen to some of the opening theme to The Grifters. Elmer Bernstein, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We've just been listening to the opening credit music from one of the new films that you've written for, The Grifters. What did you want to express in the opening music for the film?
First of all, the thematic material itself is very odd. Its closest relation would be the kind of things that they were doing in Europe, particularly Germany in the early 30s. It brings to mind perhaps something like Three Penny Opera. It is sort of faintly decadent and faintly off-center, which sort of sets the whole atmosphere for the film itself.
The Grifters was produced by Martin Scorsese, directed by Stephen Frears. Who actually brought you on, and what did they tell you when they brought you on?
Well, you know, I've always had this theory, you know, that if you live long enough, everything comes around. Marty Scorsese, apparently, and it's a very nice thing to be able to say, although it sounds immodest, but Martin Scorsese has apparently been a fan of my music for some time, and very, very well acquainted with the early films I did, and apparently particularly likes the score for a film I did in 1957, of all years, called The Sweet Smell of Success.
In a way, I think that The Grifters builds on some of your innovations from The Man with the Golden Arm, a movie that you scored in 1955, in the sense that it's a very urban music. It's a jazz-inspired music. Can we talk about 1955 for a minute?
We should, certainly.
Man with the Golden Arm was one of the first jazz-based scores. And I think it really set a trend off. The movie starred Frank Sinatra as a jazz drummer and drug addict. So obviously it made sense to use a jazz score. But what else went behind the thinking of that?
Well, if we go back to the man with the golden arm, it is precisely as you said. I mean, the atmosphere was Chicago. I mean, that's where it took place. Chicago is one of the great homes of early jazz. The main character in the film wanted to be a jazz drummer. And as a matter of fact, one of the crucial scenes in the film is when he goes to an audition as a drummer and tries to get himself a job. And that's where the idea of the jazz score grew. Jazz had been used before, more sparingly in scores. I think what made The Man with the Golden Arm seem special at the time was that the use of jazz was throughout the film, and a lot of the so-called scoring pieces, the dramatic background pieces, were also jazz-based. But the feeling for using jazz stemmed from the mise-en-scène and the main character.
Let me play some of the music you wrote from The Man with the Golden Arm, and then we'll talk more about the score.
Okay.
Music from The Man with the Golden Arm, composed by my guest Elmer Bernstein. This was at the very beginning of the period when jazz ended up being used a lot for detective movies and TV shows and hard-boiled movies and TV shows.
I'm not so sure. You know, it depends on what you mean. The Man with the Golden Arm is 1955. In 1957, you get Peter Gunn, mm-hmm. which was Henry Mancini doing a score which was basically jazz-oriented. And then in 1958, a show called Staccato went on the air with John Cassavetes, also about a detective, for which I did the score, also jazz-oriented. So, I mean, I've had very mixed feelings about with The Man with the Golden Arm. Of course, I really cherish the memory of Man with the Golden Arm because it was actually the film that, so to speak, established my career. It did something else, which I have since regretted. Studios suddenly realizing how powerful the use of popular medium can be in a film score, because that hadn't been done in quite that way before. Not quite in the way I did in Man with the Golden Arm. Not so thoroughly. And the effect of it, of course, was that the record album from the score was immensely successful. And it just sort of seemed to open up the floodgates. And from then on, score after score after score was using popular music of some kind, either jazz, and then finally it went to rock and roll scores. And unfortunately, a lot of this kind of music was used for its commercial value rather than its appropriateness to the dramatic action.
So what you're objecting to, finally, is using pop music to sell a movie or to sell soundtrack recordings from the movie. You're not objecting to using popular music itself, are you?
Oh, no, surely not. No, surely not. But I just think the shoe has to fit, you know, in a dramatic point of view. Some of these decisions, I think, are made, shall we say, less artistically. Very often a certain kind of score will be put in a movie because they think it's going to sell records, whether it's good for the dramatic action or not.
Well, at just about the same time that you were writing The Man with the Golden Arm, you were also writing the score for The Ten Commandments, which I think is one of the great movie religious epics. What kind of music do you seemed appropriate for a religious epic? You certainly want it to be big, And, of course, in Ten Commandments, you had to have music that was not only behind Moses, but behind God, you know? This is a tall order.
Yes, but we forgot something even more important.
What, Cecil B. DeMille?
And that's Cecil B. DeMille. We'll never forget Cecil B. DeMille. Actually, DeMille was very, I mean, I found that was probably the most interesting experience in my whole life in the movie business, working with Cecil B. DeMille on that film. The music for the film was basically, oh, how shall I say, the concept of the music was Wagnerian because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical cliches?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. well, necessarily so. I mean, you know, I tell you who tried to break that, as a matter of fact, was once again Marty Scorsese. And The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, sure.
In which he
yeah.
used Peter Gabriel doing a lot of electronic music. I think, you know, it was very interesting about that. When we finished the Ten Commandments, the music of the Ten Commandments, and I'd gotten to the point of that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, Mr. DeMille, sir, and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ? He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross. At the same, sort of in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politic, so to speak. And DeMille said, you know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore in the atmosphere which exists in the world today. Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the cliches, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, like what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age. And I think, indeed, it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay, well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway, where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who play shofars, of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday, and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals. There were about 8,000 people. And they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it. He hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble. It looks like the picture. And the picture is too slow. He said, now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that is... accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now, but it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical, because eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
That's terrific. Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to a conversation with Elmer Bernstein about film music. This is Fresh Air. Film composer Elmer Bernstein is my guest. Let's get to another score that you wrote. This is such a great theme. I'm thinking of the theme from The Magnificent Seven, which was a Western epic based loosely on the Seven Samurai. Now, you wrote the theme for this. It was also a big pop hit. It was in the top 40, a version conducted by Al Caiola and his
orchestra. Yes, Al Caiola did a sort of guitar arrangement of it.
Yeah, so was that good for you? Did you wish you had the hit?
No, I'm basically very unselfish that way. I'm funny about that. I don't like to see the attitudes of the music changed, and in that sense, the Al Caiola thing was very, very different. That bothered me a little bit. No, it didn't bother me that he had a hit, because I mean, obviously, it was very good for me. The best thing that ever happened with the from a purely economic point of view, that happened with the Magnificent Seven, is the theme was leased by a certain tobacco company.
We could say the name. People remember the Marlboro commercials with
the Marlboro commercial. And that's terribly funny. When I perform this piece at concerts, especially in Europe, where they still use those commercials, where they can still do those kinds of cigarette commercials, I can hear the whisper go through the audience as they hear it. And, of course, they know it better as the Marlboro thing.
Let's hear the theme that you wrote for The Magnificent Seven.
Thank you.
Gosh, I love that music.
Thank you.
At what point do you see the footage? Do you like to see rushes from a movie before you even start thinking about what you're going
to write?
Well,
you know, the great directors always have you involved right from the beginning. I mean, in the case, we're going back in The Man with the Golden Arm, the man with the golden arm, I was at the studio at the very first time the cast sat down around a table and read from the script the play. Marty Scorsese, for instance, for whom I'm doing a film, is shooting a film in Florida. We had a chat on the phone the other night. Now, Marty, who's, I think, one of the geniuses of our field, Marty wants me to come down to Florida, for instance, to see some stuff. You know, while it's a work in progress, great directors generally will do this, and they generally not only want the composer there, but really enjoy the composer's input.
What do you do if a film is re-edited and suddenly the music isn't going to work because the length of the scenes has been changed?
You know how to ask the right questions. I tell you, you know what you do? You suffer a lot, a great deal. An edit can be very, very painful because it's not just a question of cutting a bar here, cutting a bar there. Hopefully you get a chance to rewrite it and then re-record it. Now, I mean, all sorts of odd things happen. I mean, going back to The Grifters again, I enjoyed very much working with Stephen Frears during the creative period. He came up to my studio in London, and we played things for him on electronic devices, you know, synthesizers, so he could hear what the score was going to be like. And the recording was absolutely delightful and thrilling and exciting. Interestingly enough, when Stephen ran the picture a couple of times, he decided that he really wanted to change the character, really of the film was what he was playing with, and took the score as it existed, didn't change any of the music, or the music's all there, except he used some of the music more than was originally intended, and moved all the music around in the picture, which not in the way we'd originally designed it. I thought to myself, my goodness, this isn't, you know, never going to work. Well, and I didn't see what he had done. And then the picture started to be shown, and people would call me and say, gee, the music was really effective in that film. I think to myself, my goodness, you know, what's really happened here? I dare say, here's a case where the composer and the director would have done very, very different kinds of things with the music. Now, I don't know why Stephen felt the way he did, but it is possible that we wound up with very different views of the film. But interestingly enough, he could still use all the same music. It's just in different places.
Well, Elmer Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thank you.
My guest has been composer Elmer Bernstein. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's more music from Bernstein's score for The Grifters.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you go to the zoo, do you wonder how the animals feel about living there? Animator Nick Park thought about that, and the answer he came up with, the animated short Creature Comforts, just won the Oscar. Coming up, we meet Nick Park. Also, Faith Ringgold tells us about her storytelling quilts, including one about her own weight loss. And maybe you have kids who want to see the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film, but do you want to see it with them? Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Explosive experts in Kuwait are continuing their efforts to clear the minefields planted by Iraqi forces during the 7-month-long occupation. Large numbers of unexploded devices have already been dealt with. Tim Luckhurst of the BBC reports that through satellite pictures, captured documents and information from prisoners of war, Allied forces are able to tell how Iraqi generals plan to defend Kuwait City.
The Iraqi minefields around Kuwait City were designed to channel coalition forces into a killing zone held by units of the Republican Guard. Vast minefields were planted due south of the city and along the coast. The Republican Guard waited in a mine-free zone southwest of the city. Iraqi strategists believed this plan could halt a coalition assault by US Marines landing from battleships in the Gulf and absorb an armoured thrust across the Saudi-Kuwaiti border. In the event, General Schwarzkopf sent his forces round, not through Iraq's static defensive line. The minefields were rendered militarily useless. With the fighting over, the hundreds of thousands of remaining unexploded items are a serious danger to Kuwait's population. The Ministry of Health here say that several people have been injured in explosions each day since liberation.
Tim Luckhurst reporting for the BBC from Kuwait City. In Washington, the Bush administration has turned aside a request from Kurdish forces in Iraq for help in fighting Iraqi government troops. A White House spokesman says, despite regret for the suffering, the fighting is an issue that has to be settled between the Iraqi government and the people of Iraq. In his most direct challenge to Soviet President Gorbachev, Russian Federation leader Boris Yeltsin has called for a change of power in the Soviet Union. During a meeting of the Russian Congress of People's Deputies, Yeltsin outlined a program for transferring power from the central Soviet government to the 15 Soviet republics. Kevin Conley of the BBC reports from Moscow.
Mr. Yeltsin said the Russian Federation had reached one of the most complex and dramatic moments in its history, but he added there was still time to establish how it had come to what he called the edge of an abyss. His speech, a broad-ranging one, might almost have been called an agenda for the direct presidential elections he wants the Congress to approve. He spoke of the need to set out a clear alternative to the economic program of the Soviet authorities. He touched on the issue of the freedom of the press, and most importantly of all, he talked of establishing a round table, some sort of forum, he said, in which rival political groups could get together to solve the republic's problems. We have, he said, one land, one life, and ultimately one goal.
Kevin Conley of the BBC in Moscow. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has canceled a visit to Senegal next month. According to a statement, the cancellation was blamed on violence in South Africa. This is NPR News. According to military spokesmen, 3 U.S. Marines have been shot and wounded by an Arab motorist as a car passed them on a highway in eastern Saudi Arabia. It was the second reported shooting of U.S. servicemen in Saudi Arabia since troops were sent there last August. Controversial New York City civil rights leader Al Sharpton held a rally today in Los Angeles to call for the ouster of police chief Daryl Gates. Many L.A. civil rights and civil liberties organizations have already called for Gates to resign in the wake of police beatings of an unarmed black motorist. But the Reverend Sharpton said that he came to L.A. because alleged police abuse of minorities is not a local problem, but a national one. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
A couple hundred very vocal protesters gathered on the steps of City Hall, chanting for peace, justice, and the removal of Police Chief Daryl Gates, while they waited for the man who had come 3,000 miles to take up their cause. When the Reverend Al Sharpton finally appeared, he was wearing one of his trademark tracksuits and carrying a 5-foot wooden cross.
So we come to these steps on Good Friday because 2,000 years they crucified Christ. Today they're crucifying us.
Tightly enclosed in a circle of bodyguards, Sharpton carried the cross as he led the crowd on a 3-block march to police headquarters. He placed the cross on the ground there, telling some police officers to give it to Daryl Gates. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
Italian Prime Minister Andriotti has resigned, triggering a collapse of the 49th Italian government since World War II. This resignation was not unexpected, as coalition parties have been fighting for weeks over the budget deficit and changes in the structure of the Italian government. Andriotti had planned to reshuffle his government this week. In trading today in Europe, the dollar was lower. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Faith Ringgold's work may be hard to describe, but it's glorious to look at. She makes quilts that are also paintings. Her quilts stitch together fabrics of bold patterns and vibrant colors, but one of the fabrics she uses is canvas, which she paints and writes stories on. Her quilt, Tar Beach, has a border of clashing and floral patterns. In the center is a painting of a family picnicking on the roof of a Harlem building. This is an autobiographical image. Summer nights after sundown, her family used to gather on the tar-covered roof of her apartment building, which they called Tar Beach. Tar Beach is also the title of her new children's storybook, which is illustrated by her quilt paintings. Ringgold's work is represented in the permanent collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Modern Art, and the Studio Museum of Harlem. Ringgold loves fabric, and she was surrounded by it when she was young. Her mother was a dressmaker.
I was brought up with little pieces of fabric, and I was always sewing and making things, you know, but then I would discard them because they didn't look, you know, I mean, we're trained to feel that everything's supposed to look like it's commercially produced. And so I didn't really like my little fabric pieces. I wish I had some of them now. But it wasn't until the 70s when we women artists were trying to find out what women's art was, trying to identify who we were as women and what is our culture. I'd already been through the 60s where I had done that as a black person, going back to my African roots, using African art as my cultural stimulation, as my my route to define myself as a black person in art. And now I was doing it again as a woman. And those two experiences totally shaped my art.
Did you know other black artists or other women artists when you were getting started?
As a young student, no. I did not. I had to find these things for myself. I wasn't taught about any black artists when I was in school. I never had a black teacher in my life. I went to school in New York City. The school system has always been very segregated. Now it's all people of color. When I was there, it was all white, just about, with some black schools here and there. But I didn't learn any of that in college. I had a problem trying to paint people with brown skin like mine, and I used to make them purple and orange.
Is it hard
green.
To find the right colors for the skin tone?
Yeah, especially when you're not being taught, you know. And my professors, they thought I was being exotic. They said to me, "What are you trying to do? You know, why don't you just go ahead and paint people?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean, which people? What are you talking about?" So, I mean, to them, you know, there was only one kind of people, white people. I mean, what are you trying to make up something new here? And I had to find out for myself. And in the process, in trying to mix colors to represent the browns that I was interested in making, I came up with orange and green and purple and all kinds of things before I finally was able to teach myself how to create the hues of black people.
I want to ask you about one of your earlier quilts. This one is called Who's Afraid of Aunt Jemima? Mm. What was the significance of the Aunt Jemima image for you that led you to want to do a quilt on it?
Well, I was always quite turned off by people's hatred of Aunt Jemima because of her size and her color and the way they used to change her on the boxes. You know, the Aunt Jemima pancake box? If you look at the early ones, when I was a kid, she was much darker. She had her that cloth was tied in another way, and her nose was wider, her lips were fuller, and she was fatter. Now she's thinner, she's lighter, the nose is thinner. I mean, what is all of this? And so I wanted to pay tribute to all of these Aunt Jemimas that we have in all of our families, these strong and very powerful women who sometimes don't pay attention to their weight because they're so busy nurturing and feeding the whole family, you know. And it seems to be a kind of enigma among people that there is often this auntie or this sister in the family who negates her own life and existence to take care of and provide for other people. And that's what I associate with Aunt Jemima, a woman who cared and took care of people. I just couldn't understand why people would want to hate her.
You did a story quilt about your own weight loss.
Yes, I did.
You want to describe that quilt?
And I guess also I associated myself very strongly with Aunt Jemima because, you know, I was fat too, and you get a lot of flack from people when you are, you know, they kind of care about you less. They feel like you're big, so you can take it. They lean on you heavily. That quilt that I did about weight loss was a public commitment to lose the weight. And a performance also, which documents the performance and the quilt documented all the decades of my life. I was born in 1930, so I did a whole collage of photographs of me in the 1930s, in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, to see when it was I gained the weight. In the 30s, I wasn't fat. In the 40s, I wasn't. In the 50s, I used to model for my mother. I was very slim. In the 60s, I got married the second time, and I began getting fat. The 70s, I gained even more weight, and the pictures show that. And then the 80s, I began even more. And by 86, I had reached enormous proportions and really decided to lose it. And so I went on a liquid diet. And then I left that and went to Weight Watchers and lost the weight and changed my whole way of eating, stopped eating meat and dairy. And it's a constant struggle, but I keep it public because that way it's not just between me and the food.
You grew up in Harlem, and you still have a studio there. Mm-hmm. How has Harlem changed over the years?
Well, we don't have police protection. That's one thing. And when you don't have police protection, that means that crime sometimes runs rampant in the street. We're not overcrowded. That's good. We don't have to worry about the crowds of people and all the smog from the businesses. It's actually quite a lovely place to live. It's close to everywhere, you know. I mean, the transportation is great. The people are friendly. I feel at home. I'm not a minority there. I've lived there all my life. I live in a beautiful building. Everybody says hi to me coming in and going out. When I go away, they miss me. When I come back, they're glad to see me. It's wonderful living in Harlem. Of course, you don't roam around late at night by yourself, but then you don't do that anywhere in New York.
That's right.
You know? I find I have never had any kind of criminal problems in Harlem. Nobody's ever attacked me, or I've never been robbed, either in my house or on my person. I never had any problems living in Harlem at all. It's just been wonderful for me.
So what keeps you in Harlem, that sense of community?
Yeah, I like not being a minority. I like the idea that when I look around, I see a whole lot of people like me. I go in a store, nobody follows me around thinking I'm trying to steal something, you know. And that happens a lot, you know. It doesn't make any difference how you're dressed or who you are. you know, there is this stereotype that, you know, if it's black, it must be doing something wrong. So I like that. At home, at least, I can relax and just be me.
Well, Faith Ringgold, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been real fun.
Artist Faith Ringgold. Her new work is a children's storybook called Tar Beach. A retrospective exhibition of her work is on tour through February 1993. It's currently at the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo. This is Fresh Air. On Monday night, while we were all at home watching the Academy Awards, Nick Park was in his tuxedo getting one. He won an Oscar for Best Animated Short. His short Creature Comforts is a big hit in the Fresh Air office, so we called Park to congratulate him and find out more about the film. Park works with clay animation. That's the kind of animation that makes the California raisins move. Creature Comforts is a parody of news documentaries. It's a slice of life in an English zoo. Animals speak reflectively into the microphone about their accommodations in the zoo, the weather, the food, and what they miss about their native country. Here's a turtle, an ape, and a Brazilian cougar.
Yeah, well, it's reasonably comfortable, I suppose, this place, but, I mean, I've been in more comfortable rooms, yes.
Well, sometimes you can't get out and about as much as you would like to. You're stuck in for some reason, like I'm stuck in today. And then, yes, you get bored and you get fed up with looking at the same four walls.
I miss a lot of the food. I miss the fresh meat, you know, because in Brazil we are predominantly carnivores. We are not, you know, vegetarian, and we don't like potatoes, we like meat.
Nick Park, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations.
Thanks very much.
The short that won the Academy Award is a parody of the vox pop, of the man on the street kind of interview. Why did you want to parody that?
Well, it was just the way it ended up, really. I didn't actually set out to send that up or anything. It was just a funny way of dealing with an animation film, I think, because animation is one of the most contrived things. You know, it's totally contrived, and documentaries are seen as being uncontrived. And so I guess it was, in a way, a comment on documentaries.
Where did you get the voices from?
They were all recorded in people's homes and almost on the street, not quite. We had to go around looking for people with interesting voices, interesting accents, and who had a lot to say.
Did somebody interview them, or did you give them scripts to read?
None of it was scripted. It was all just genuine interview. And I just had to structure the questions in certain ways so as to get the kind of things that animals might say if you interviewed animals in a zoo. So I went to, like, old people in rest homes, and there was one guy from Brazil who made a very good candidate because, you know, a lot of the animals in a zoo may be brought in from another country, and he just talked about how little space there is living in Britain in the accommodation, and he hated the food and the weather and that kind of thing. So I thought that he was quite a very fitting candidate.
When you interviewed the people, because you wanted to use their voices for your short, did they know how they were going to be used? Did they know that they would be the voices of animals?
Yeah, well we explained. You know, we had to get the permission to use it, and we explained. It was very difficult, though, because there was really nothing to help us explain what it was exactly going to look like. You know, we didn't know whether they were imagining, Tweety Pie or what. You know, because we were, you know, when you say animation, a number of different things comes into people's heads, and there's not a lot of clay animation around, so we couldn't quite explain. People have different names for it: claymation, clay animation, tabletop puppet animation.
So describe how that works.
Well, it's very much like making a cartoon, you know, any old cartoon. But in a cartoon, you have to draw many hundreds of drawings in order in order to create the illusion of movement. Whereas with puppet animation, you have one figure and you use the same kind of camera that would film a cartoon that takes one picture at a time, but instead you would just move the figure a very little bit each time and take another picture every time you move it. And that, in the end, would give the illusion of movement.
But the thing is, you have these terrific facial expressions for all the animals. How do you change the facial expression on a claymation puppet?
It's sculpting, really. You're sculpting with a sculpting stick, and you're getting inside the mouth and manipulating the plasticine or the clay each time. And on different syllables and different words, I have to put new teeth in to, you know, to create the right look for that particular expression. And I have to do that many thousands of times.
Give us a sense of how long it takes for you to complete each minute of animated film.
Well, a minute would be about 1,500 frames. On Creature Comforts, I was getting through about 5 seconds of dialogue a day, which is about 125 moves. So the whole film took about 3 months.
Now, you were competing against yourself in the Academy Awards, right?
Right, yeah.
You had two films in there.
I got two films in there. My other one, A Grand Day Out, was in, which took 6 years to make, by the way.
So did they give the award to the right one, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I wouldn't have complained if it, you know, either of them getting it. At present, I'm working on the sequel to my other film that was nominated, and so it probably would have done that a lot of good in terms of raising money for that film.
You know, when the documentary category comes up and the animated short category, I think everybody, that's when they go get a snack, you know, if they're watching at home. It's not like the most awaited award. Did you get a sense of that as you were walking up to get the award, that this was like the low priority award for a lot of the people there?
I think you're generally very aware that it's not, you know, it's not the feature film award, you know. But for me, it was enough, you know. I think for me, it didn't matter that it was one of the minor awards. It was just, you know, I may never get this chance again kind of thing, and all my friends are waiting and watching, you know.
Well, let me congratulate you and let you get on with your day. Thanks for talking with us.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
Nick Park's Academy Award-winning short, Creature Comforts, is featured in the 1991 Festival of Animation. It's currently at the San Diego Museum of Contemporary Art in La Jolla. April 5th, it opens at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. Park will be there on the 5th and 6th.
Where I would like to live and to spend most of my life, in a hot country. You know, in a hot country that I have a good weather, and that I have space, and that I have trees. You know, it means a tropical country. Not in an island, a cold one. It's easy. Any part of the world, but hot. Name it, and there you go.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. NPR's Jackie Lydon tonight reports from Beirut as people in that city attempt to restart their lives after years and years of civil war. John Fronmeyer, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, defends his organization's funding of a controversial movie. In Chicago, Ira Glass rides with some police officers in that town and talks with them about their views on the necessary use of force in their jobs. And I'll be talking with two college students who have come to Washington to protest the U.S. military budget, especially the spending in the Persian Gulf, when so many people in this country are homeless.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The largest grossing movie in theaters this week is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. And over this holiday weekend, the young ones in your life might be demanding to see it. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a grown-up's guide to the film.
Let's talk for a moment about education in America. Maybe it bothers you that the most many American children will ever know about the Renaissance is the names of the four Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But look at it this way. Donatello, Leonardo, Michelangelo, and Raphael are among the most pervasive cultural phenomena of our time. And what do you know about them? Do you even care that the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie is a whole lot better than the first one? Does it matter to you that the cinematography is bright and watchable, that the sound is clearer, that the fight sequences are wittier, that the pizza looks tastier? Do you give a hoot that you can now almost tell the turtles apart? Of course, maybe you're feeling a little intimidated. Your kid has been developing his expertise in the field for years now, and you look at the subtitle of the movie and you say, "The Secret of the Ooze? I'll never catch up now. I don't even know what the ooze is." Let me put those fears to rest. Believe me, you already know everything about the turtles. And that's because the idea of heroic turtles is the only new idea their creators seem ever to have had. Everything else here is borrowed from somewhere familiar. The black-belted youths with a wise old mentor, well, that's half Karate Kid and half Star Wars. Their hideout in the subways and sewers, Phantom of the Opera by way of Beauty and the Beast. Their favorite saying, cowabunga, that's the Howdy Doody show. As for the rest, well, it all sounds pretty much like teenagers eating pizza, as in this scene at their friend April's apartment.
Yo, April!
Hey, what it is?
Yeah.
We brought a dinner.
Let's see.
Pizza!
Yep.
Again.
Pepperoni.
Please, please. A moment to reflect. Okay, I'm young.
Yeah. Just like Sam.
Enjoy. Ninja pizza.
Ninja pizza?
Pizza that vanished quickly without trace.
Is there a plot? Almost. A mad scientist, played rather well by David Warner, is trying to dispose of some radioactive ooze he's created. For a while, the movie seems to be telling us that he has dark ulterior motives. But that thread, like many others, is quickly dropped to make room for fight scenes. Meanwhile, the villainous ninja called Shredder, who was killed in the first movie, but not completely, of course, is back. And he wants to get hold of that ooze. It turns out that it's the very same stuff that mutated some innocent turtles into our heroes, and the Shredder thinks he can harness it to destroy them. His main ploy involves creating a couple of mutant monsters of his own, and these have been delightfully well-designed by the late Jim Henson's Creature Shop. The climactic fight scene somehow unites these googly-eyed mutations with a performance by the rap star Vanilla Ice. And though I don't think we're meant to credit the ooze with his creation, the juxtaposition is striking. In the end, Turtles 2 is a painless way for adults to learn what their kids are yapping about. Painless, and possibly reassuring, too. To see this movie is to realize that being obsessed with the Turtles is no dumber than being obsessed with any other four mystical, high-living, vaguely reptilian culture heroes. By which I mean I'd take them over the Doors any day.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Our production assistants are Roberta Sharaf and Eileen Delahanty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the stars of one of the funniest shows on TV, David Alan Greer of In Living Color. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.